Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about developing web resources for COVID-19. So there's a lot of them out there. I'm going to discuss them in general. This particular site, which I'm organising an organisation to give an award to and sort of develop it a bit more. So there's insights into why we'd have an award and how we're going to develop it. It'll be quite exciting to look at. And so what I'm going to do is, I suppose, give a little bit of a background on where I'm coming from, you know, why you listen to a podcast, the sort of the world out there from the web perspective in terms of all the web resources and things like that. And then this site and incredible directions that we'd like to take it for to address certain issues. So coming along, I'm doing podcasts, part of cognitive rehab, where it's the mental thing of being able to speak quietly, produce it, think about a topic, organize it in your head, and present it. Now, it's not necessarily the best rehab, but it's, you know, the best rehab would be interacting with people socially and working on a day-to-day situation in real life. So in terms of a shadow of real life, it's perhaps the more challenging shadow. So I've done podcasts for the last, oh, I suppose, 3 years now, where I've just gradually struggled learning to speak, remember things, and go across. And there's sort of a small audience overseas, I think, who tune in, listen to various things. And, you know, what happens is like, if I go really badly, I sort of, you know, scare people off. People aren't listening to it. And then as I improve, people say, oh, yes, look, there's some interesting aspects there as I sort of struggle through. Given that, I think the real situation is that not everyone's got perfect understanding, and necessarily the people who get up on the soapboxes and discuss things aren't going through the process of struggling through understanding. So I think there is a small niche of people who want to struggle going through, or can tune into someone else struggling through, sort of, or struggle through reading a Wikipedia article, or reading a philosopher, or exploring some maths, or going through some elements, or some chemistry, or some quantum physics. I'll be just struggling my way through, not an expert. Somewhere between an expert, someone who's not an expert, not an acclaimed public speaker, not a podcaster, just a normal person going out. And this may also be interested in the actual real world of an Australian garden where I'm actually podcasting from. It's actually a rather blissful, quiet thing which goes through. Now, blissful is not the world of COVID-19 and web resources. So I think what the web is not a product. It's a marketplace where there's lots of people selling lots of wares. And so you can, it's a dangerous place, an interesting place, a fascinating place. But it's not a simple place where, you know, one thing gets produced and then it goes to everybody. There's a lot of hype. A lot of people waste time in their life and waste time on the web. Now, the COVID-19 is something which is science-based, and so there's not a tsunami of information, but grades of information. So if you're a scientist and you read the web and you educate people, you've known about pandemics forever and the structure of it, and you're aware of it's sort of certain things aren't news, and people are realizing for the first time that people have a silly attitude to it. This is sort of like a revelation, like the stuff that Donald Trump comes out about. I think the latest is a drinking disinfectant and letting sunlight into your lungs to beat it. It's that type of ignorance is not necessarily a surprise to scientists, because you've been going across it for a while. But then there's a whole heap of, you know, it's a worldwide epidemic. There's data trickling in, over different time periods and different reporting processes, in terms of it is similar to a warfare situation. And this hasn't been the first time that there's been a flood of information, and it's been very hard to pick out what is correct in order to make decisions. And I'll sort of go back to World War II and the Americans in the Pacific. So if you imagine geographically, a very large situation, different groups and organizations reporting things. It was a huge flood of information, and they developed a maths for this, where there's certain information they could say what it says and what it probably indicated. Now, if you actually pull back and say what the information probably indicates, and it's less than that, or you could make a firm statement, these are true. So pulling back from the sort of the detail, and where you get sort of a worst case scenario, you can actually get some parameters. And as you get these general insights, they form lines or regions in a multidimensional space, and you draw lines across it, and you create an area of most likely truth. And that's actually called simplex algebra, and I've actually used that a couple of times in life. Not as multi, or I suppose multidimensional as this, but where the information is not exact. And if you go in with a attitude of getting exact information, you can't actually get a rational conclusion. It's sort of like suspending a conclusion, letting the data process itself. So simplex algebra, if you can imagine, are a series of equations with less than or greater than sums and speculative ratios. That you know, it's less than this ratio is a general thing, which is less than an equation. So you eventually get a series of linear equations. I think that generally it has to be simplex algebra has to be linear, and that gives you a space. Now the interesting thing is that space can be, say, jelly beaned shaped, so you can get a minima, and but then pull out from a minima and come down to another minima. Very, very interesting aspect of it, and it's a very interesting thing if you combine that with artificial intelligence and some of these heuristic algorithms to go through. So that's sort of a success story, US in World War II, dealing with the data across. And I think a lot of that understanding, I think a lot of people don't sort of pick up that with progress, there are lessons learned, but lessons forgotten. And I think the 1918 flu pandemic is a lesson learned, but a lesson progressively forgotten. And it's forgotten because new solutions tended to negate the lesson rather than augment it, if that makes sense. So we began to treat flu antibiotics, not with antibiotics, but with vaccines. And so we progressively forgot the lessons going forward. So I suppose it took me a while to actually go through various sources, and so for various people, there's like you want information for free, and people, advertisers, want revenue, and these two things are incompatible. So you have your sort of first call of international news, you go to newspapers and news sources and news bulletins, and it's where the information goes into a political process through a politician or through a newspaper, through a reporter, and it's collated. And there's sort of basic things like that. So things going through a reporter, you get the story put together with sources and implications and analysis and stuff like that. But eventually, as the same story but the different numbers come across, you sort of eventually cancel out or neutralize what the newspaper or the reporter is saying, and eventually you want to get to the exact numbers. And particularly if you've been trained in statistics, as I have been, manipulation, stuff like that, you need an overview to test your hypotheses. So this is sort of a data-rich environment, and a data-rich environment is a sort of a scientific environment. And there's also the knowledge come across. Now, let's sort of talk a bit about scientific knowledge. So this is an RNA coronavirus. So there's people who've listened to podcasts before. I've discussed what RNA, DNA is, and the process there is. So this knowledge you can actually fairly quickly pick out fake news or manipulated knowledge. That is, people are using this, and I put this as a low life, sort of almost equivalent to the unthinkable of I think Australia has had shipments of fake face masks. Now, if you actually do look at a face mask, there is, say, out of 100 people who say face masks, say a good face mask and a fake face mask, say a face mask doesn't work, and 75% of people using face masks, even the best face masks, will catch. It won't be effective. And say you've got a fake face mask, and say it's got a placebo effect, all this aspect, double blind effect. That's it. And anyway, right? If you sell fake face masks by organised crime, you are in effect responsible for 5 deaths. That is, there's a process of, there's 2 different ways you look at deaths. You can say what is a sequence of events which caused the death, and therefore no one's guilty. Or you can say the differential effect of a fake face mask versus a real face mask, that type of aspect of it. And in that way of looking at it, you can say that particular person is responsible for a death that would have otherwise happened. Okay, I'm going to have to stop here for the moment. Okay, beginning again after that brief interlude. It wasn't at your end, but my daughter and various people came out to the garden to look at all the plants they pruned back ferociously during the drought and have come back up again. Okay, we're getting up to this point of what you call, obviously, negligence, but these many varieties of negligence. So what happens is at some point ignorance turns into negligence, or naivety turns into negligence. And this is actual fact, a good point that as you work along, you realize that what I'm doing overall, even though I think I want it to be good, is not good. Now, obviously, people doing fake face masks, they are providing information that people will use, thinking it will help them, but indeed, overall, it won't protect them, won't help them. Now, in terms of, and in that sense, it's bad, and it's an incredibly stupid thing, because there's a huge profit margin on face masks anyway. So essentially they could quite legitimately set up a real face mask industry and still make a handsome profit. And the only differential between a fake and a real face mask is, say, a few dollars. So a fake one would, say, cost $1 to make, a real one $5 to make, and if they're sold at $70 each, that's sort of a very small fractional. It's sort of like being evil for evil's sake. But when you start off, you sort of, obviously the people doing this aren't necessarily ethical people thinking the way through. Now, when it comes to web content, there's actually various things which are good to a particular time and through ignorance become not so good, and that they expose problems if they do things. Now, there's lots of websites out there, and then there's sort of different grades of ones. There's the Australian government ones, which go through, and they're a little bit difficult to access and collate, but they're very measured and rigid, and the Australian government processes go through, and so there's a reporting chain, and at a certain point in time it goes into a department, and that's signed off and collated and checked, and the statisticians and various people, there's all the protocols, and it comes out in a written paragraph, which is correct, and which goes through there. So there's this thing about, I suppose, information, whether it's written in text, tables, graphs, and in all these ways, these have different... So in a table, you need to have the text in your head, know how to read a table. In the text, it's very low and it's very clear. So a lot of doctors write text letters because that's very clear to someone afterwards what's going through. Then you have the graphical ones, which is more getting more artistic and more web stuff. And they have very great for qualitative things. You can see a general trend. So the earlier data, things that you would you can it's a graphical data is scaled data, so there's information to do with color, size and position. And I suppose if people are not trained in logarithmic graphs, there's sort of an area of maths education to read it, so a non mathematically trained person, it's sort of like an acquired taste. I suppose it would be a bit like a fashion parade, catwalk. It's a lot of people, you're going out, and a lot of people go... So I'm just trying to think what would be like to be a non-mathematician, non-mathematical person, to see a graph. There's these famous things, I think Florence Nightingale allegedly inventing the pie graph, and various people doing things, say, for Napoleon's disastrous campaign, or the... there's a lot of public health graphing things which you get the communication through. I think there was the famous Dr. Swan, it was possibly, I can't remember his name, in who did a merge of a geographic graph of a geographic region, superimposed data of cholera outputs. Now I've forgotten what his name is. So often public health issues or dangerous things that have a dramatic point in history where you can often be forgiven for a particular graph. There was a very famous graph in Australian history which sparked our first recession, and we haven't had a recession for perhaps 30, 40 years after this one. I can't believe, probably 30 years. But this is all tracked down to this person having all the blankers in one room in Australia, which he can do because Australia's got sort of the population of, back then, a fraction of the size of California. So it is possible to have everyone who matters in one room. And this intern, I think, basically got up with the old overhead projectors. I don't know if you can remember the acetate sheets and the pieces of cardboard on sticky tape, which you would reveal. So the important thing is so you could direct people's attention to it. And he did something to do with exposure to debt of the worst countries in the world. And then Australia was worse than the worst. And then people didn't have mobile phones there, but they went out and communicated to the various people, and we had the recession, which came across and sort of restructured the Australian economy. People said we won't have that again. So you've had Australia from that situation. So you've got the graphs there. Now, let's talk about the information coming through, or the thing which I sort of find... very tough to do is that You are not computer literate and you want to access this information, you've got a moderate amount of computer literacy, so you're not using your smartphone and swiping to just colourful clickbaits. You sort of tend to be the good old read a web page, research a web page, research things. You'll be taken into looking at Worldometer. And Worldometer is something that I've used in class to teach people about population. See the population and environmental issues, Worldometer, because they give you live pictures of the live number of cars and prisoners and, I don't know, coal mine and carbon dioxide mine, to give you an idea that this is an issue which is happening right now, and the number of births. It's something that by the end of the lesson, 3,000 people will have been born on Earth, or something like that, to actually show it happening. So Worldometer was a natural platform for coronavirus, and for some reason, although it's a volunteer organisation, it has expenses. Well, it's hard to say. But it has a lot of expenses by selling a lot of its content to advertisers. So it has some advertising stuff. Perhaps it's not so sure that a lot of the sophisticated advertisers, when they place an advert, you get the permission to go into a web page. So in your web page, you can sell a section for advertisers. And it says, well, look, this section is free. You can... we will rent this space of our web page and you can put it in. And what they put in there is a picture, but they also put in something called trackers. So you can be on Worldometer for 10 minutes and you'll get 300 trackers, and a good fraction of a day you'll get something 3,000, 5,000 trackers. And this is something to, when your computer goes slow, you go through a routine of checking the internet speed. Thank goodness we've got optical fibre all of a sudden in Australia. And so there's sort of the same bottlenecks, and I don't know, they're just out. And so they've got this normal installation blues where storms hit, you know, calamities are working their way through the system. But you check various things, viruses, background applications, and then you go through trackers, you clean off the trackers via different programs, CC Cleaner and Avast Tracker Remover. It takes a little bit of a while, especially when the trackers are in a full swing. And sort of looking at the different browsers, you can partition trackers into different style browsers. So ideally, you'd want to open up Worldometer. The trackers are quite sophisticated, so they take a while to purge. So they take two or three goes with tracker removers. So it's not. So these people who have put in trackers, so a tracker basically gives authorization for someone. So there's trackers and cookies. It's a slightly separate thing. So a cookie is a piece of file that the website can read. So if you ask it, you ask a request, it can then send a question to read your cookie file and work out information about you, to work out what's going on. Okay, should go in here. I see what's happening here. I don't know how long I can keep on doing it. But let's talk about, so Worldometer. It's great. It gives you all the countries, all the basic information, and it's of various quality for different times. I'm going to probably have to stop now as this goes through. I'll take this up at a later point. podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.